Well, thank you very much. It's a delight to be here. I really appreciate the opportunity to come and share some of the exciting things that are going on in the Cornell campus with you. And it's particularly exciting for Spencer and I to be able to be here today, since we're coming right off the heels of this Cornell Genetic Ancestry Project reveal event for a sampling of 200 undergrads that we had on Thursday, April 14th, in the Cornell campus. This is the sort of banner that we have for the event that we had, as I said, and really this represents a true collaboration between myself, who am a full-time faculty at Cornell University, and Dr. Spencer Wells of the National Geographic and Explorer in Residence and director of this Genographic project, which you'll hear more about. Spencer is also a Frank H.C. Rhodes class of 1956 visiting professor at Cornell, and I engaged him in this because of his ability to communicate so well with the public about ancestry, about genetics, and other things. And so it's through his visits over the past couple years that this idea really hatched to, in fact, have a Cornell Genetic Ancestry Project. The question you'd be asking is, why have a Cornell Genetic Ancestry Project? And really, fundamentally, the motivation is one of education and awareness and engagement through participation. And by that, I mean what we have been interested in doing is trying to engage a broader group of Cornell undergraduates in understanding something about the power and the promise, but also the limitations and constraints and the risks and other things about the use of genetic testing in a variety of different venues. This includes increasingly the use of genetics in terms of medical testing, the evaluation of disease risk, the evaluation of toxicity to drugs, whether in fact the tumor type you have is of a particular genetic variant that allows a particular treatment and so forth. But fundamentally, one of the things that is true is many students simply aren't interested in the science typically. But if we can in fact capture their interest through genetic ancestry, maybe we'll get more of them engaged. Now, why genetics? Okay, so many of you know that sort of a little over 10 years ago, the complete, so-called complete genome sequence of humans was first sequenced for a price of about $3 billion. This is basically the 3 billion nucleotide or little letter instruction manual for making a human. And it's basically made up of these four letters, A, G, C, and T. And while this sequence now has been read off, interpreting that sequence, understanding all the pathways that go from that simple genetic instructions to the complexity of a human, the so-called phenotype, going from genotype to phenotype, this is an area of a tremendous amount of very exciting research going on, much of it at Cornell in Ithaca, also in collaboration with colleagues here in New York at Weill Medical School, and certainly colleagues in other places around the country. Now, one of the things of interest is that if you take a look at this sequence, we're not all the same. In fact, we differ between other individuals, say, within this room. Individuals, the two sets of chromosomes, this instruction manual that you get between your parents, you have tens of millions of differences between the two copies you got from one from your mother and one from your father. You don't even have the same exact number of genes, probably differences in genes that, in fact, control your ability to smell and things like that. So there's an enormous amount of diversity in there, and understanding what that variation means in terms of differences in phenotype, differences in resistance to disease, how you respond to medications and things, your risk for various, cardiovascular or other kinds of things. This is, in fact, one of the exciting sort of challenges of modern life sciences. Now, it's also true that comparing amongst these differences, we'll see, also is something that is, in fact, the basis of much of the work that goes on in a group that I direct of 25 faculty called the Cornell Center for Comparative and Population Genomics at Cornell, which, in fact, draws on expertise that fundamentally tries to understand how you analyze all of this genetic variation, both within human populations, within plant populations, among different species, and how can we learn something about why those differences exist, what the functions are, and things of that nature. And certainly many of my colleagues at Cornell have various research projects and things themselves that are of probably quite strong interest to many of you, such as Ruth Lay's, for example, the work on the human gut biome, Andy Clark, associate director for the center, and Adam Siepel, also associate director, who do a lot of work on Andy Clark, as well as particularly Alan Keenan and Jason Mazey, do a lot of work on the analysis of genetic variation associated with various clinical trials for cardiovascular disease, other kinds of variations and mutations and things. So this group of colleagues, we have basically a core of expertise, scientific expertise, and we teach courses, but we've been interested in trying to engage a broader group of students in understanding what you can learn from these tools and these methodologies that many of us work to develop. And it was in that context we wanted to help students and the community at large learn and engage in actually what is DNA? Where does it come from? How do you study it? Why is it important to understand something about DNA and genetic variation? What can you learn from differences in DNA? And why do some people have objections to DNA testing that is done in various contexts? Now, the deepest motivation in some respects is also how can DNA testing improve the quality of our life? And this has many applications increasingly in medicine, in diagnostics, and in treatments, particularly some strong success stories coming in the treatments of cancers and so forth, where the specific type of cancer mutation can be identified and targeted with a specific drug and things. Also, in fact, susceptibility to and whether you metabolize certain drugs fast or slow and things of that nature. These are all things that one can learn from this. But we didn't want to engage students in anything that was actually going to tell them anything about themselves medically, and that's why the focus on genetic ancestry to sort of initiate this engagement in the process. Now, Cornell is a remarkably sort of global institution. In fact, it has campuses and groups essentially all over the world, and it draws a student population that comes truly from across the entire globe. The question we wanted to pose was, what would DNA reveal about our students' ancestry? What if we randomly sampled a group of students? What would we find about their genetic ancestry? Could we use that as basically an entree to capture the enthusiasm and interest of a larger group of students? So what am I talking about in terms of genetic ancestry? Well, think simply about families. This could be your family. So this might be your mother and your father, and you might be one of four children. And in fact, your brothers and sisters don't have children. You do, in fact. This could be your spouse, and these are your three children here. And over time, populations are fundamentally just groups of families. Okay. Now, as we go through time, they pass their genes down from generation to generation. Now, there's an interesting thing. As you think about it, if you think about going back up in your ancestry, most people think, okay, I have two parents, four grandparents, eight great-grandparents, so forth. It's an expanding sort of network. Well, interestingly, if you trace individual genes and focus on these individuals down here indicated in black and go backwards through this, you, in fact, find that they all go back to a single ancestor. The single, what we call a most recent common ancestor in the past. And in fact, how big the population, all those things determine how fast you, in fact, go down through that. In fact, over time, each one of these little ticks here is a generation. There's a chance that a mutation occurs, an error occurs somewhere in that DNA. And in fact, some of these have medical consequences, but many of them don't have a significant consequence at all. And they just simply accumulate over time. So, and if we look and add down across over that, we'll in fact see a series of differences that will accumulate amongst the DNA sequences down here at the end. Okay? Now, so the question is, how can we go about sampling 200 undergrads to sort of infer something about this kind of ancestry, to look at their sequences down here and infer something about who's more closely related to each other in a deep ancestry kind of perspective that Spencer will talk about. So our approach was to, in fact, take and email 4,000 undergrads in the beginning of the semester, work to the registrar to email out to them on 2007. We didn't know who it went to. The registrar picked them randomly. We had a website for our project where the students could learn all about the DNA testing, the consent forms and everything. And they basically had a registration that opened January 30th at 2 p.m. By, in fact, 14 minutes, we had 116 students that signed up, and I closed the registration at 216. We only had the resources to pay for 200 kits. February 1st, we had a sampling event. Spencer and I both gave talks about the Cornell Project and about the Broader Genographic Project. The students listened to those talks and then lined up to go through again their consent forms, to have any questions answered about them, and so forth, and to see some pictures of the kinds of results that they might, in fact, learn. And the students were tremendously excited. It was fun for Spencer and I to walk the line and talk with the students because they were so excited by this, and they brought their friends that even couldn't get kits and things as well. And then we swabbed their cheeks. And this is a simple swab. Spencer will show. It's pretty much like brushing your teeth, except you reverse it and scrub the inside of your cheek. Those cells come off all the time and, in fact, contain DNA, enough DNA to be studied. Basically those swabs are taken, put in a little tube, and that was then taken back to the Genographic labs, where the DNA basically samples were introduced into little sample trays here, essentially kept track of with a ID number. The actual DNA sequence of their DNA of particular sequences Spencer will talk about was determined, those results look something like this, and he'll explain what these mean. These are, in fact, are the actual individual segments of DNA of four different individuals. And from these, as you'll see, we could basically read out these little sequences down here, and as Spencer will show, one can place them on the human evolutionary tree in terms of where they fall. Now, before we talk about some of those results, I want to go briefly to a quick clip. We also engaged students, in this case, in a class that Marilyn Rivchen was teaching, an undergrad class in film documentary making. They're putting together a whole series of documentaries about the project and different kinds of things. But they also put together a brief little intro, and I just simply want to go to that. So this is on YouTube, and it's also available through our website. And let me go to full screen here.
Irish, German, Scottish.
I'm from Singapore.
Irish.
Basically all my ancestors are German as well. As you can see, I'm Asian, I'm Chinese.
I'm very, very proud of my Jamaican ancestry.
About a quarter Italian and a quarter German.
All of mankind almost came from like a specific location or a specific spot. Something like this kind of shows how everyone sort of came from almost the same part of the world or the same community, and they branched out like that.
So in a way, people are connected, but at the same time, I think that to some degree, it's a little bit more vague.
Sometimes it's nice to be in a little bubble where you think that you're different. I'm not sure why that would be a good feeling to have, because I guess it's the nature of humans to want to be connected and be social. So, I don't know, it's really weird that I have that feeling.
Hopefully, you know, there's a lot of history of thinking like there's a genetic basis to race and maybe helping to overcome that. In the end, it's something that's really difficult to overcome. I think like each generation makes some sort of progress towards being more interconnected, but not completely.
I just think it's awesome how we're all linked somehow. Like the further back you go, the further connected you are.
And it's like I feel this instant connection that I feel like needs to be there. But I don't know how to describe it other than it just feels right.
So thank you for that introduction, Chip. And I just want to point out that that film clip was made by a very talented young undergraduate documentary filmmaker named Kai Keen, who's in Marilyn Rivchen's class. I think he's got a bright future ahead of him. Okay, so Chip gave you some general background on the project, what we did at Cornell, why we did it. I just want to take you through a little bit more about this whole idea of testing ancestry using DNA. Really, it's a kind of genealogical approach to the whole issue of human origins and human journeys, how we've populated the world. So if you think about, you know, there are probably a few people in the audience who've done this, making a family tree, and you go back over the birth records and so on, and you start to piece people together. But what you're doing is you're working your way back into time, okay? So you're starting with relationships in the present that you're certain about. You and your siblings share a parent in common. You and your cousin share a grandparent in common. And you work your way further and further back into the past, adding ever more distant relationships. Now, what happens eventually as you're doing that? You hit what the genealogists call a brick wall, a point where there is no written record. And then we enter this dark and mysterious realm we simply call history, and ultimately prehistory. But it turns out we're all carrying inside of nearly every cell in our body something that allows us to see back beyond that brick wall, a historical document in our DNA. And the cheek swabs that we used at Cornell and at this event in Queens that inspired the Cornell event that was featured in a film that came out on the National Geographic Channel a couple of years ago, The Human Family Tree, that DNA allows us to see back to the very earliest days of our species. Now, quick primer, reminder of some of the stuff that Chip said. Long linear molecule, famous double helix described by Watson and Crick back in 1953, composed of four subunits, A, C, G, and T, the nucleotides, the billions of nucleotides that Chip mentioned. And in every generation, this huge, long document has to be copied to be passed on. And it's like copying the longest text you can imagine. So think about a long book, say War and Peace. Multiply that by 1,000. And imagine copying every single letter in that book by hand. That's what has to happen every time this DNA is passed on. So as your parents passed on their DNA to you, they had to copy all of these billions of letters. And because it's so very, very long, on occasion, just as we would, you know, make a mistake in copying a text like War and Peace, you will make a typo, a spelling mistake. They're called mutations when they occur at the DNA level. And if you share one of these genetic markers with another person, that means you share an ancestor. Person who first had that change in their DNA in the past and passed it on to the two of you. So by looking at people all over the world, focusing in particular on two lineages, the mitochondrial DNA and the Y chromosome. Now, mitochondrial DNA is inherited down a purely maternal line. It tells us about your mother's 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 mother. The Y chromosome is kind of the equivalent on the male side. It's the piece of DNA that makes men men. And so fathers pass it on to their sons. It tells you about your dad's 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 dad, all the way back to the very first father. By looking at the pattern of genetic variation, the pattern of these markers in people from all over the world, we've been able to build family trees for everybody alive today. So everybody in this room, in fact, everybody on the planet, falls somewhere onto one of the branches of these family trees. Okay, now what's the take-home message? They look kind of complicated sitting out there in the audience. Well, simplifying them, turning them on the side so that they look like a real tree with the root at the bottom and the branches coming off the top, it's that the deepest split in the human family tree, the longest branches, are found in Africans. And because the length of these branches is proportional to the number of changes that have accumulated over time, ticking off in a clock-like fashion, what that means is that Africans have been accumulating these changes for longer than any other group. And therefore, we originated in Africa as a species. Now, that's not such a revolutionary idea, because Darwin suggested that way back in the 1870s. On the basis of the fact that we have chimps and gorillas that look somewhat more like us than any other apes, and they're found in Africa. And he said, well, you know, as with all apes, we must have come from Africa. But he was talking about millions of years ago. I'm talking about our species. So even a generation ago, in the field of physical anthropology, people might have guessed, yes, ultimately, we probably came out of Africa. You have all these hominids that have been found there over the years. But different human populations have been accumulating diversity and diverging from each other for millions of years. What's amazing from the genetic data is how recently we share African ancestry. An African man, in the case of the Y chromosome, who was walking the savannas of Eastern Africa only 60,000 years ago. That's 2,000 human generations, the blink of an eye in an evolutionary sense. So it's only in the last 60,000 years that we've left Africa to go out and populate the rest of the world. And from the work that we've done over the years, this is really the goal of the Genographic Project, to piece together these migratory routes. The evidence is that there was an early coastal migration leaving Africa shortly after that 60,000-year time point, moving down through India, following the coast of South Asia, down through Southeast Asia, reaching Australia by around 50,000 years ago. Slightly later inland migration, moving up into the Middle East between 45 and 50,000 years ago. And these would have been inland hunters. This is during the last ice age. They moved eastward onto the grasslands of Central Asia, encountering woolly mammoths, having to develop portable shelters and sew warm clothing together. Some groups turning westward into Europe, the Cro-Magnon people, who settled there around 35,000 years ago, drove the Neanderthals to extinction, created all that great cave art at Chauvet and Lascaux and all the famous sites that we've heard about. And then a small group heading up into Siberia and eastward, crossing a short-lived land bridge in Beringia, connecting the old and the new worlds between 15 and 20,000 years ago, and settling the Americas. The great Paleolithic wanderings of our species, how we populated the world. And again, the goal of the Genographic Project is to figure out the details of all of these great migratory routes. Now, what about the event at Cornell? Now, Chip described the swabbing process and how we chose the students and so on. And as he said, we had a reveal event last Thursday up on the Ithaca campus. And it was a packed auditorium, and we had some of the students there talking about their stories. And we presented the overall data. So what's amazing is how diverse the Cornell student body really was. So I mentioned this event that we had done in Queens, and the story we told in the film, Human Family Tree, was effectively the story of all of our migratory histories, because we found most of the world's major genetic lineages in that one potentially interbreeding population. Pretty amazing. And really, that's the changing face of the world today. People are moving and mixing to a much greater extent. Well, we saw at least as much diversity in the Cornell student body. Again, 200 randomly chosen undergraduates. Most of the world's major genetic lineages, 5% typically Native American lineages, 14% East Asian, 5% African, Sub-Saharan African, a little over half European from all over Europe, Northern, Southern, Eastern Europe, South Asian / Central Asian about 11%, and about 8% typically Middle Eastern lineages. So just an incredible amount of diversity. Now, in the reveal event, we had some of the students, as I said, talk about their stories and got their reactions. So these are a couple of the kids who participated with us. There was one person who wasn't there. I'll mention him in a minute. But this is Mackenzie Malia on the left, and remind me, Emil Chang on the right. He refers to himself as the other Chang, because when he was in school, everybody was surprised that he had the last name Chang. And he's like, no, it's not the Korean guy sitting next to me. It actually is my name. And so for Mackenzie, she looked at her mitochondrial DNA. She doesn't have a Y chromosome, obviously. And so what she found out is that she's carrying a typically Native American mitochondrial DNA lineage. It falls into a haplogroup. A haplogroup is basically an ancestral clan defined on the basis of shared genetic markers. And so A was one of the founding lineages to make it across the Bering Land Bridge between 15 and 20,000 years ago. So one of the earliest groups of people to enter the Americas all those years ago. Now, her reaction to that was kind of interesting. She knows that her family comes from Bolivia, but she said they always identified with their Spanish ancestry. She said, my dad has blonde hair and blue eyes. We never thought we would actually have any connection to the native communities in Bolivia, but it turns out to be somewhat more complicated in her case. And she thought it was really amazing to have this connection, this newfound connection, to the native peoples in Bolivia. Now, for Emil, he had two very different stories. So through the project, he tested his mitochondrial DNA. But he had already tested his Y chromosome a couple of years ago. He's very interested in what genetics can tell him about his ancestry and his family history. What he found was on his mother's side, the mitochondrial side, he's a member of haplogroup L2, L2A in particular. And this is a typically sub-Saharan African mitochondrial DNA lineage, found at very high frequencies in Central Africa. So if you think about the pygmies of the Ituri forest, a lot of them belong to this L2 lineage. It's also found in Western Africa, and it's very common in the African American population due to the African diaspora, the slave trade. So not such a surprise, I suppose. But you look at his Y chromosome side, and it's a very different story. He's carrying a very typically East Asian genetic lineage that tells, you know, a story of his ancestors migrating out into the Middle East 45 to 50,000 years ago, heading eastward toward Central Asia, and then eventually entering East Asia around 30, 35,000 years ago. Additional changes occurring on his Y chromosome as all of these migratory events are taking place. And the one that finally defines him as a member of haplogroup O3 probably occurred between 10 and 15,000 years ago in southern China. And it's very widespread in East Asia today. 70% of Chinese men fall into haplogroup O3, and about 30, 40% of Japanese men. It's found throughout Southeast Asia as well. The reason it's so widespread is because it's really a marker of the expansion of rice agriculture in East Asia. So think about the big events in history, people leaving Africa 50 to 60,000 years ago and so on. The next big bang in human evolutionary history was when we settled down and became farmers about 10,000 years ago in several locations around the world at the same time. That's when our population went from, you know, a few million people struggling to eke out an existence as hunter-gatherers to the 7 billion we have today and on track for 9.5 billion by the middle of this century. So that big bang led to a population expansion, and we see evidence of it in people's DNA. So we see certain lineages in West Eurasia that are associated with the expansion of wheat and barley agriculture, and then this O3 lineage in East Asia associated with the rice agriculture expansion. So very, very different genetic lineages on his mom's and dad's side. And again, that's really the face of the future as we move around and mix to a much greater extent than we ever have. And that's revealed in the census data. So the census data that just came out a couple of months ago from 2010, but also in the 2000 census, the first time that people could declare themselves to be of mixed ethnicity or mixed race. Before, you had to choose one. I'm African American, or I'm Pacific Islander, or whatever. Now you can have all sorts of combinations, and people are declaring that, and we're seeing an increase in the amount of mixing that's occurring. Now, the final story that we told in the reveal event was this guy, Daniel Klein, Dan Klein, who couldn't be there because he was off at a debate contest and was traveling, but we did get him on the telephone, which was kind of fun, and it added a real kind of urgency and feeling of a live event to what we were doing. So he had his Y chromosome tested, and I told him, we had a private event for the students who'd swabbed their cheeks on Sunday before we did the big public event. So I told him that he was carrying a Middle Eastern, a very typically Middle Eastern Y chromosome lineage when we met, and he's like, that doesn't make any sense, because yes, I'm an Ashkenazi Jew, but you know, I identify with Europe. You know, I have blonde hair, I'm European. So why am I carrying this Middle Eastern genetic lineage? Well, he belongs to a very interesting lineage, haplogroup J1. In fact, he's a member of a subgroup known as J1C3D. And this lineage is at very high frequency in Middle Eastern populations, about 70% in the Arabian population, for instance, the Arabs living down here in the Arabian Plate. Also found at high frequency in North Africa. When we see it in people from Europe, it's almost always found in Ashkenazi Jews. And of course, there was a diaspora, as we all know, the Jews originally coming into Europe from the Middle East. And so J1 is found at a frequency of around 15% in Ashkenazi Jewish populations. Now, why is it shared between Jews and Arabs? Well, it's an interesting story. We don't absolutely know that this is true, but the thinking is that J1C3D originated somewhere here in the Fertile Crescent, probably in the northern part, up here in present-day northern Syria, and it scattered all over the Middle East from that origin. So it originated about 10,000 years ago, 5 to 10,000 years ago. Up here in this part of the Middle East. And as I said, it's found all over the region today. Now, in terms of why it's found in Jews and in Arabs, we know, for instance, that the Jewish tribes and the Adnani tribes historically see themselves as being connected through one person. So the Adnani Arab tribes, these are the northern tribes found in Arabia. Muhammad would have been a member of these tribes. They trace their descent from Adnan. He is the historical figure they identify as the patriarch of their line. And Adnan was the son of Ishmael, and Ishmael was the older son of Abraham. Now the Jews, of course, trace back to Jacob, or Yisrael was his other name, who was the son of Isaac, who was the second son of Abraham. So the biblical, the story in the Torah and the story in the Quran, predicts that basically they should be sharing the same Y chromosome lineage. And in fact, it's borne out in the genetic studies. Now we can't absolutely confirm this, we don't have Abraham's DNA, but you know, it's like building a court case. The evidence is that, you know, perhaps this story is true, maybe there is some truth to that. So it's kind of a cool lineage to have, and you know, he was suitably impressed. He said, you know, although I'm Jewish, I do eat bacon, I'm not gonna stop eating bacon just because I'm a descendant of Abraham, but anyway, it is kind of cool to think that I might be descended from the patriarch that gave rise to the world's three major monotheistic religions. Now, what about your story? Some of you guys have swabbed your cheeks. I think most of you have. And I'll be happy to talk to each one of you about your results separately. But I just wanted to show a couple of the examples. So we have Brian Walsh. Is Brian around? Yep. OK. So Y chromosome haplogroup R1B. Have you looked at your results online yet? You haven't. OK. So I'm also a member of R1B. So is Chip. So hello, cousin. Thanks for coming. So R1B started off in Africa, just like everybody else, and your ancestors were part of that second major migration into the Middle East between 45 and 50,000 years ago. And they went wandering off into the Central Asian steppes around 40,000 years ago, and part of that group that turned westward into Europe, the Cro-Magnon people, and so they were the ones who encountered the Neanderthals, and they're the reason why the Neanderthals are no longer around, our ancestors. Now this is all during the last ice age, and as the conditions worsened, and we hit the last glacial maximum, about 16,000 years ago, all of Scandinavia, most of Britain, they were covered in ice sheets. And the region right next to the ice was uninhabitable. So everybody living in Europe was forced down to the south. They headed for the beach during the winter, which, you know, is a good idea. And our ancestors made it down into Spain. And so they overwintered the worst part of the last ice age in that Spanish refugium, as we call it.
And as the ice melted, starting around 15,000 years ago, and started to retreat, people repopulated Northern Europe from these refugia. And so today, this is a very common lineage in Northwestern Europe. 70% of British men, 95% of Irish men, and even 80% of Basques in Spain, all coming out of that refugium. So it's that post-glacial repopulation of Europe from Spain. So does that agree with you, with what you know about your dad's side?
Yeah.
Where are your ancestors from on his side?
Ireland.
Okay. So there you go, Celtic.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, Dr. Steve Salvatore, who I don't think is here. He had to leave, but I was talking to him earlier about his result. He has another very interesting lineage. So he's a member of Y chromosome haplogroup J2, defined by the terminal marker M172. And so his ancestors also, of course, started off in Africa and were part of that second major migration. Most people living outside of Africa trace back to that major migration to the Middle East. So 45 to 50,000 years ago, and they liked it there. They stayed put. They didn't head east into Central Asia. They stuck around, and they were among the first farmers in the Middle East. So we talked before about the origin of rice agriculture and the expansion of O3. J2 is indicative of the expansion of those farmers from the Fertile Crescent in the last 10,000 years. And so today this lineage is found all over Southern Europe. Steve's ancestors come from Italy, Southern Italy in particular, so we see very high frequencies of J2 down in Southern Italy. It's also found in North Africa and parts of Central Asia as well, but it delineates that expansion of people with the spread of agriculture. So just some good examples of the kinds of cool stories that you can find out, and I urge you to ask me about your results if you were tested and got the results back. If you want more information on what we did up at Cornell and the ongoing process of engaging the students about genetic ancestry testing and other forms of genetic testing, or if you want information about the project, check out the websites. Happy to open it up for questions. Yeah. Yes?
I have several questions. One, where can one be tested if one is not a member of Cornell? And number two, I'm kind of interested in mutations. I know some of them occur to survive, but do we know more about mutations, how they occur? And the third part is, I'm wondering, we live in a very drug-oriented society, whether drugs can promote mutations.
Okay, you may have to remind me, so the first question is easy to answer. Go to our website, genographic.nationalgeographic.com, and you can order a kit.
Or just come see me. I can get
it. And so, but the idea is that over 400,000 people have participated through ordering a kit so far. So it's been a tremendous response, and we're very pleased. In terms of mutations, mutations are just this kind of random background chatter. As I said, as the DNA is being copied, you misincorporate one of the nucleotide bases. So it's exactly like a typo. And for the most part, they don't have any effect on your phenotype, your appearance, or a disease state, or whatever. They're simply neutral baggage that gets passed on from one generation to the next. In fact, the fate of most new mutations is to go extinct within a few generations. So very few of them do ultimately get passed on. But the ones that do, again, are kind of like evolutionary baggage. Now, in some cases, they're adaptive. They give you an advantage, evolutionarily speaking, and they increase in frequency as a result. In some cases, they're bad. They cause a disease. But for the most part, they're largely neutral. And what was the final?
The drugs. We live in such a drug society.
Right. So the drugs, certainly some drugs. I mean, we know that smoking cigarettes causes somatic mutations, which is why you get cancer. There are other drugs that cause somatic mutations. In terms of increasing the background rate of...
What is somatic mutation?
So this is the tissue in your body. It's not the germline that passes on to the next generation.
Oh,
it's not the sperm and the egg. It's
about passing on.
Yeah, so there's no good evidence for that, not the drugs that most people are using.
Well, I'm talking about street drugs, too. If you have a kid who's taking LSD,
all the stories that were told back in the 60s. That was a very good PR campaign on the part of the U.S. government.
But is it true?
No, as far as we can tell.
Question
you might have
brushed
it,
and I just missed it. Unless my biological father had a son, is there any way for me to trace my paternal?
No. You need that Y chromosome.
Or
you can go to a cousin.
Did he have brothers?
Yeah, a direct male line cousin.
Yes.
Okay.
He's still alive as well, so I could just have him swap.
Sure.
Yeah.
Oh, Yeah, you can, if you can, you can go back up, even if you can't, even if you don't have, you can go back up a few generations and come down another one, because these, the kinds of changes that are being studied here are ticking, are ones that tick at a slow enough rate that it really provides this deep, deep history.
Right.
You can look, there are many more markers you can look at now that can resolve, you know, familial relationships, even a much closer relationship. But in fact, so again, it depends on the scope that you want to try to cover.
Thank you.
What is the ultimate aim of the the geographic project? Is the idea to get a much finer understanding of basically the sort of family tree of humanity, where we've gone?
Exactly.
Before, okay.
Yeah.
Let me just, I'm going to answer one additional question from the woman back here with regard to these mutations. I mean, one of the things that is really actually exciting, this paints the history of ancestral migrations. On top of that, one of the things that Spencer said is there's an enormous, this spread around the world was really very, very recent in terms of evolutionary time. And what is remarkable, in fact, is the tremendous diversifications there are in different parts of the world in people and morphology and phenotype and things like that, and skin color in terms of ability to metabolize milk and things like this. So there's in fact a tremendous amount of strong sort of evolutionary adaptive change. Things in Africa and in the Mediterranean areas that were exposed to malaria, for example, led to significant genetic changes that, in fact, actually have medical consequences now. And so there are some, you know, there's a tremendous amount of opportunity for insight there that's all painted on top of this ancestral, you know, sort of history of migrations. And in fact, there's a tremendous amount of sort of interesting biology, evolutionary biology, and comparative population genomics that is coming out of that actually has significant medical implications as well as interesting evolutionary stories.
Absolutely.
You have these lines on the maps, and they're, I'm having trouble interpreting them. I'm wondering, you have the line, for instance, going across from Africa through the Fertile Crescent, into Turkey, crossing over through Bulgaria, and then ending up in Spain. Is the group you're talking about found in Spain 5,000 years ago, or would it be found all along that line so that there would be some people in Turkey today who would have that?
Yeah, so it's all along that line. So we see, for instance, J2 at high frequencies right around the Fertile Crescent today.
Today,
so about, 35% of the Lebanese population, for instance, very high frequency there. But it's also found up here in Turkey and in Greece and over here, and even up in the UK at very low frequencies.
Okay.
But it tends to be more indicative of kind of Mediterranean ancestry.
One way to think about these lineages, I think that's helpful. Think about if you basically pass on a phone number. Remember, there's this game that people used to talk about, phone, you know, whatever, you know, sort of where you basically, you know, say the phone number to one person, they'd say it to the next person, but someone went around the room and came back, the phone number was different. Well, you could actually trace, because in fact, each of those changes accumulated on the changes that occurred before. And so that's in fact what defines the spread of those branches. As you see numbers going up, those are accumulation of new additional branches, and that's what allows Genographic Project to basically pinpoint where on that lineage individual falls. The further one they went out, the further there is, in fact, an additional mutations. But in each of these cases, I mean, another way to think about this that helps is that for the Y chromosome like this, it's sort of like a gift that each generation the father gives to the son. And there's a certain chance that there's a change that maybe occurs, a little dent or something else in that atrophy or something like that. But it's only passed down specifically. But in the case of Steve's, I mean, his exact Y chromosome really did follow that particular path. He has a lot of other genes that, depending on how complex his family history was, could have had many other paths and things, but this was in fact the path
his father's
Y chromosome path through history. And so again, this comes back to the interest in indigenous populations, as Spencer's had, is that these are populations that have certainly shifted around, and there's been remarkable stories through the history of humanity about movements of populations. But many follow fairly simple paths, and this provides insight into some of those.
little, excuse me, the blue offshoots, what do they represent?
So they're related lineages.
Okay.
So they have, for instance, M168, they have an out of Africa marker, and M89, the Middle Eastern marker, and then they shot off to the east.
Okay.
In this case.
But those are sort of paths not taken in terms of...
In terms of his particular ancestry.
Okay.
On the website, you can see all these other ancestors.
So it's,
atlas.
It's more of an FYI, so...
Kind of, yeah. Shows how
so
you're related
to
other
people.
To they are related, but just further back.
Okay.
So they don't have the final defining M172 change, but they have M89, and then they went off over here.
So that represents the only times that those happen?
What do you mean?
In other words, just...
Well, those are the ones that track the lineages, so they define the tree. To the tree.
Those mutations only occur once on each of those.
Interesting.
Yeah. And the focus is on changes that occur slowly. There are other parts of the genome that change
faster. So you're
faster.
Picking up these changes, you know, one after the other, and they define the structure of the tree. And so J2, that's the M172 marker right there, you know, it's a collection of related J2 lineages defined by that terminal marker that you had that one before and that one before and so on. So, you know, that's how you get the tree structure.
Is that what you expected to find?
And Steve?
Just basically, obviously you've been working with these for a very long time. As far as understanding how they branch out and how they mutate.
Right.
And is it what one would expect, the frequency? As a scientist, I mean, not as a...
I mean, we really didn't know what to expect when people started working with the DNA of indigenous groups around the world. I mean, back in the 80s, there was a lot of debate about whether Africa was where we really originated. You know, some of the earliest fossils were found in the Middle East. So, you know, that was really the kind of revolutionary finding, is that we came out of Africa very recently.
Does M actually stand for mutation?
Yes, marker.
And you can do them all with only three digits?
Well, you know, there's a lot of work that went into that. These are the defining ones for these lineages.
Right,
there are others,
I mean,
that have occurred.
I've noticed they're all three digits, either two or three digits.
Oh, no. So that's the order that we discovered them in at Stanford when I was a postdoc there in the 90s.
Okay.
So there was M1, M2, M3, all the way up to like M800 something.
Well, but it's still less than 1,000.
Yeah, pretty much in terms of defining markers.
Oh, okay.
There are some new ones beyond that, but they tend to be rarer. Otherwise, we would have discovered them before. Yes?
I hope I can ask this well. It's kind of confusing. But I've noticed, I've traveled quite a bit. And for example, I noticed when I was in India, I went to... where the Jewish settlement was, the Cochin area. And
I've
they
been there too,
looked,
it's fascinating.
They looked so Indian.
They are.
But if they started in the Middle East, say, and then you go to Europe and you see the European Jews and like the German Jews who've lived there for generations, they look so German. So is it, I'm trying to grasp your mutation and I'm trying to grasp...
Well, that's simply due to the process of mixing over time. You know, although these are endogamous populations and they retain that connection to their history and their culture and religion and so on, people have moved into the population from outside. And so if you live in a place for 1,000 years, 2,000 years, you know, 3,000 years, you're going to absorb other genetic lineages, and you're going to start to look more like the people surrounding
you.
They
only lived there several hundred years. Since 1492.
Okay. No, they went there after the fall of the first temple. Then there were later migrations.
The Indians?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I thought
Benny
the 1492 went.
Years.
Yeah. No, you're thinking of...
And
so
they
claim
they kept marrying their own. Yes.
You're thinking about the Sephardic Jews. Very different story. They were forced out by Ferdinand and Isabella, who were
yes,
from Columbus.
Yes, but when you visit them today, the few that are left there, they look very Indian, and they claim they have not intermarried.
Well, they certainly have, because they've been studied genetically.
They don't have to marry.
Yeah, they're very advanced.
If you were to test them, would you see?
Well, you would expect to see some retention of these Middle Eastern lineages, probably more on the mitochondrial side, because historically you get, you know, your Jewishness from your mother, and so your father could be from anywhere. But yeah, you would have the retention of some of these Middle Eastern lineages, but also a lot of Indian subcontinent lineages, and that's exactly what we see in those populations.
I'm sorry, I missed the question.
Oh. What would you find out if you tested that population?
I think you've been trying to ask a question.
Yeah, I was wondering if either of you are familiar with the personal genome machine from Jonathan Rothberg. an ion torrent?
I've certainly heard of ion torrent. Yeah, it's one of many sequencing technologies that people are talking about. It's kind of fourth generation.
Yeah, yeah. And if there's any, if you've used it at all, if there's any plans to use it on the project or at Cornell?
At the moment, no. I mean, in part because we're not going to do whole genome sequencing because we're not doing anything medically relevant. So the markers that we look at, and we have started looking at markers outside of the Y and mtDNA and the rest of the genome, but they're all these neutral markers that have no effect on your phenotype, such as disease state. If you sequence somebody's DNA in its entirety, you're going to pick up a lot of medically relevant stuff, and we want to avoid that.
Yeah, at Cornell, in terms of, from a research standpoint, there we have a whole series of different technologies for sequencing. The iron torrent is one of the ones that's on the radar screen for possible acquisition and so forth. But right now, we've not chosen to go that route. It is, I think, again, as Spencer said, it's a completely sort of enormously rapidly accelerating landscape of technology. As the original DNA sequence, the public DNA sequence, it was estimated to cost somewhere about $3 billion, so a dollar a base. Now you can publicly get your sequence done for in the order of
$5,000.
Yeah, $5,000, $8,000, pretty good sequence. And that within a few years, it's going to be probably in the order of $1,000 or in that range. And in fact, this raises the important and interesting question that is going to be why, I mean, educating students and the public in terms of this information is so important. Is this is going to be something that insurance companies are probably going to actually want to cover potentially, particularly sort of early on, like there's testing for a variety of PKU and other things now at birth. If, you know, many medical tests now cost $1,000 to carry out the test, but if you can get your whole DNA sequence and understand various genetic markers that may affect your ability to metabolize lactose, your ability to metabolize drugs, how you respond to different kinds of things, this could be very, very powerful. The science about interpreting those differences and what they mean is also an evolving landscape as well. And in fact, this is an area where there's much hype and much misconception about just how informative these markers are for whether you'll get a particular disease or things. Most of these are not light switches. They're in fact things that it's more like one of these
probability increases or decreases your risk.
Right. Yeah. It's like one of these dimmers on a light switch. It may increase a little bit. It makes a little brighter, a little bit darker, but it doesn't mean lights are going to go on or the lights are going to go off. And understanding that and the fact that that information, you could get your sequence now and your sequence will stay your sequence your whole life. But the information content of that sequence changes absolutely daily. And it's going to continue to evolve. This is one of the really exciting aspects of the study of genetic variation now and relating it back to function. And again, people need to understand how you deal with this. How are people going to respond to this? How are they going to know where to go and get accurate information about this? How are they going to interact with their physicians? How are they going to make decisions about whether they have children or not? I mean, there's a tremendous amount of education that needs to occur. So that's why we're interested in doing it.
Could you clarify the way or the reasons why you research mitochondrial DNA apparently more than the Y chromosome DNA? I mean, it's not that you do this and you do this. It's you do this or you do this.
We try to look at both, but you can
usually
only...
the results I've read deal with mitochondrial.
No, there's a lot of work being done on the Y chromosome. It's just that only half the population is carrying a Y chromosome. Remember, everybody has mtDNA though. It's easier to work with. We know we're going to be able to study somebody's mitochondrial DNA, but you have to be a guy to have a Y chromosome. So
you could test your Y lineage if you could test your father or brother or something. But you yourself can't participate.
Just for me though, there's no way you could test Y lineage.
No,
you don't have a Y.
Whereas with a man, you can test his Y lineage
or
and his mitochondrial DNA. That answers it.
You mentioned most mutations that occur sort of neutral or lost. They don't Is there anything about these markers that made them stay throughout human
chance.
History? Just chance.
Just chance.
And they just
as far
to
as we can tell,
them.
Yeah.
And in fact, the fact that they probably don't have an effect. I mean, a lot of mutations initially when they occur are actually probably bad. And they simply get eliminated out. We never see them. And then the ones that don't have an effect, you filter through, and that's where many of these are the ones that simply don't really have an effect, and so they're simply just markers of the
descent,
the
ancestry.
Sort of descents and ancestry and ancestral migrations.
Speaking from a purely commercial standpoint, my own, thinking about writing a story about this, or proposing to write a story about this, is there a next step for the Cornell Genetic Ancestry Project in terms of publications or a publication that is envisioned within the next year?
Absolutely. So there's a variety of different things. So, this is really a real-time experiment. I mean, in fact, actually, the reveal last week was truly, we had, up until shortly before that reveal event, we didn't know what the results were going to be. It could have been that we had 200 students that all traced back to Western European ancestry. We simply didn't know what it was going to be. And again, because we chose to do it pretty much like the street fair project in Queens, where you simply sampled random individuals. So there are a couple things that emerged out of that. One was we did get this amazing diversity, which was interesting in itself. I don't want to make too much about that, the particular representation that is, because that's of the lineages. What it's more important, some of the interesting stories that emerge from those lineages. We are going to have a series of there will be some videos, and the students are putting together documentaries. We will at Cornell work together and put together a documentary that talks about the overall project and the full vision and things. National Geographic may piece together some things as well for themselves, their own use. There will also be on our website, follow the website, there's going to be a whole series of things there. There's tremendous interest among students who didn't get tested and perhaps, can we get involved and how can we get involved? So we are going to try to continue the involvement of students next year. One of the things that, as I say, motivated a lot of this was trying to engage a broader group of students. And so actually Spencer will be helping me next spring teaching, and he's been helping with me with a class this semester as well, a class that actually engages students in this, and we're hoping to have a broader engagement of actual participation in the genetic testing at that point on a volunteer basis. That's been selected to be one of six new university courses that'll be open to students across campus. There are other follow-ups on this because, of course, there are aspects of the social implications, the legal implications. What about the medical testing and things? There are, NCAA athletes now, all Division I NCAA athletes are required to either be tested or to provide evidence that they were tested or sign waivers for testing for sickle cell anemia. In fact, because if they have the trait, if they're heterozygous for it, there's some evidence that they are at greater risk to die during severe training and things. And so we're going to continue to try to expand the interest and awareness of this. And it's going to be an evolving thing. A lot of the student documentaries, May 8th is the end of the semester when they present theirs. So my hope is that we're going to be able to, by the summer, have a very complete set of video presentations and other kinds of data presentations of the material that comes out of this. There is a lot of interest in other universities doing a similar kind of thing. This is the first time where this partnership has really occurred between a university and Genographic Project to randomly sample 200 students in this way. And it's been a fantastic experience from us at the Cornell
perspective.
It's been
a great learning experience for us as a project, and CHIP has been a wonderful partner. So.
Yeah, no, I think, and so those are, yeah, so there's a lot of things that are going to continue to emerge from this. And again, both with regard to the general project, checking back at the Genographic website, but also our the Ancestry Project website, there'll be things that will be showing up on that that'll provide a lot of links to a lot of the videos and other kinds of things that are coming out of it.
Thank you.
For the larger geographic project, is there an endpoint to this, or do you just keep gathering data, gathering data?
At the moment, no.
Okay.
No, it's very much ongoing. It's going to shift later this year. You know, we have now collected about 72,000 samples from indigenous communities around the world. We're on track to hopefully hit somewhere around 80,000 by the end of this year. And at that point, we've really done the majority of the sampling that we need to do from those groups. We'll continue to sample in a small way moving forward. But in terms of having 12 regional centers that are actively out there collecting samples on a daily basis almost, we're not really going to need that in place. It's really a question of analyzing the data at that point and perhaps looking beyond the Y chromosome and mitochondrial DNA into the rest of the genome.
And so just why is it so important to gather from indigenous groups?
Because these are people who, as Chip said, have stayed put for a long period of time. They provide a geographic context for their genetic results. They have a connection back to their ancestors in that geographic location that lots of the rest of us have lost. So, you know, I have ancestors from all over northern and western Europe, and I live in the eastern seaboard of North America. What does my DNA tell you about ancient migration in those places? Not a lot. It's a much more, about more recent migration. But there are people who've lived in the same place for hundreds, thousands, even tens of thousands of years. And so they give us that insight into their ancestors' genetic patterns and allow us to track these migrations geographically.
So it allows you to get better information specifically about migration patterns?
Yes.
Okay. Less noise, that's good.
It puts you, as you see, it gives you slices back through time. As you go back, it actually provides the sort of temporal sort of picture that, I mean, I think one of the Genographic has done such a wonderful job of piecing together the anthropology, the sort of archaeology, all the other kinds of sort of stories and information to actually put together this overall picture. And there's been a lot of, you know, work in the general scientific literature as well on different components of this. But it's in fact all those things that together have led this. Let this whole story sort of build, and in fact, now on top of this, as I said, there's a whole new host of stories that are beginning to emerge about the individual aspects of adaptation and change that have been associated with disease, or changes in diet, or changes in climate, and other things. So, it's an amazing emerging story.
I think we could probably talk about this for a lot longer. I am very conscious of people's travel schedules. So I wanted to encourage you not just to visit these two sites, but if you had any specific questions for either of our speakers, to get back in touch with John Carberry, who is on your email address for all of your invitations, and he'll be able to field all of those. I want to thank you both so much. As you can tell, this is fascinating for all of us.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you guys for participating. If you haven't participated yet, please do.
Please be squad.